I believe there are two ways to approach our lives. One is looking at it as a series of norms we have to live into and objectives we have to achieve. This view is full of expectations, pressures, bias, and systemic dynamics that continuously need to be overcome. The other is to look at life as a series of choices we make and goals we set for ourselves, a life that is full of agency, growth, and opportunity. Welcome to Live Stoked and Lead Stoked, where we explore both life and work from that latter perspective. I'm your host, Sarah Bettman, coach, consultant, and speaker. More importantly, I'm a fellow traveler on the path towards living my own stoked life, and I'm passionate about helping others do the same. Let's jump into this exploration of life and work and what it means to live and lead stoked. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited. I have John Goldfield here with me today, and he's coming in completely blind to what we're going to talk about. I asked his permission for this. Now, why John Goldfield is important to be here with me, and I promise I won't use both his names for this whole podcast, is he was my first ever partner on the ambulance. And it feels like 100 years ago, but it really was only 30-ish. And we were in the Elvis Mobile. Do you remember the Elvis Mobile?
I do.
Yeah. And there were a couple life lessons. And when I thought about starting this podcast, there's a thing you said once and a story we've talked about. And it's one of those things that I may remember totally different than you that I use as a leadership lesson for all the work I do. I will share it here in a second, but I want us to actually dive in and let you introduce yourself. And I'm going to start with the question I asked everyone, because I love the answers. And it started as a joke, but now I kind of am asking it. Is first, what does it mean to live stoked? And recognizing that's my word, having grown up in California, what would your word be for it?
Well, I grew up in California too. So.
Yes, you did. Not far from me.
Right, exactly. So I understand the stoked idea. To live stoked, I embraced a phrase several years ago now, maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, something like that, that involves the word awesome, that's similar to stoked. And that was essentially paraphrased to, you can either be negative or awesome, and you have to choose one. And it wasn't as simple as just being negative or positive. And it wasn't just as simple as being negative or not negative. It was really like, negative is one thing, and awesome is this whole sort of concept of really just embracing everything that's coming towards you and really looking for those things that are good in everyday life. Like I'm one of those guys who's always, you know, I'm pretty easy to please, and I can find one little thing in my day that was really awesome and cool, or that, you know, makes me stoked, and that's enough to say that it's a win.
Nice.
So that's kind of what that means to me.
So, and tell us, you know, kind of run us, you know, 30 years in condensed format, but, you know, how do you come to be here and how do you live that?
Yes. Well, I rode a really crappy old bus with a girl named Sarah Bettman for a while, and that was fun. And that was the beginning of my paramedic career, which led me to wanting to become a physician assistant, a PA. And that brought me out to North Carolina. I went to Duke's PA program and then worked out here in orthopedics for about 6 years, in emergency medicine for about 11 years, and then just recently semi-retired to the North Carolina Medical Board, where I'm privileged to get to work and read and see very interesting things and do lots of public outreach and not have to work nights or weekends anymore, which is really nice.
And I've got to ask you this. You have a whole also side hustle career in running. Were you a runner back then?
So I was never a runner back then. Now in high school, I did run some 10Ks just for fun, but never really took it seriously. And somehow when I was transitioning from orthopedics to emergency medicine and was a little bit unhappy with my life and what was happening and was trying to lose some weight, the usual things, you know, I was trying to walk my dog and then started to run my dog and then started to run a little bit. And I decided as a bucket list item that I would run a half marathon. And I figured if I could run 10 miles, I could probably run 13. So I'm going to do this half marathon and I can just check it off the list and be done with that. Right. And then just run a couple of miles every once in a while to lose some weight. And the guy that I ran it with then posted on Facebook after that we were training for the marathon next. And I said that I wasn't, that wasn't part of the deal, but it was on Facebook, so it had to happen. And then I ran two marathons. The first one sucked. And so I figured I'd try to train better and do the second one. And it sucked more. And I thought, wow, running really isn't for me. It's really awful. And somewhere in that transition, I started running on trails. I changed my running style a lot. I wasn't trying to go fast. I was trying to go slower and be easier on my body, and really ended up embracing this whole different concept of trail running, which then was just a slippery slope into ultra running. I would never in a million years, 10 years ago, if you told me that I would be running 100 milers, I would say that you're crazy. But that's, I have done 600 milers at this point and multiple other lesser distances, although one I did over the last summer, or actually last April was in Portugal, was not 100 miles, but it was probably the hardest race I ever ran because it had so much elevation gain. So just these epic, amazing, awesome adventures that I've been able to find myself in. And really just even getting out my front door and getting into the local state park here has just been a really incredible addition to my life. So yeah, running, I wouldn't call it a career because it doesn't pay very well, but but yeah, I definitely have found running. It kind of saved me. It definitely buoyed me during COVID because I was working in the emergency room during that time, and has helped me through a lot of, you know, life issues that have come up and stressors. And I have found an amazing community through it and have gotten involved in a 100-mile race here. My first 100-miler was the Umstead 100, and have gotten involved with that to the point that I've been put onto the board of directors, and I'm a major part of the staff there now. And, you know, it's kind of my new family there too. So,
well, and I know I'm teeing up this thing that I'm going to lay out there here in a second, but you actually inspired me as well, because I had done marathons. But my first marathon coach was a high school sports coach, and I was with Team and Training, and he was a Team and Training coach. And he had that idea, if you're not running, it doesn't count. And part of my story in episode one, and you know some of this, is I burned out body, mind, and spirit because I just need to go harder. And I think when you've been in ERs or paramedics, like, you have to ignore your physiology for a second in order to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get this stuff done, right? And so I would just push myself and go harder and harder. And I could never get my heart rate up because I thought I was out of shape. Well, actually, I was just adrenally fatigued and couldn't do it. And so exercise actually contributed to my burnout. And I'd like to tell you I'm a fast learner, but I am not. And so just at 50, my husband and I did 29-29 Everesting. And what I loved about that event is you have your own experience, but it's going slow. It's learning zone two. And I realized, had I done my, you know, death ride, the cycling events or the Wente 8-hour, any of these events with a focus on zone two and going long, I would have had a totally different experience. And it was your video of the, I don't know if it was the Tahoe Rim. I feel like you started in Carson Valley somewhere and then ran up the hill. And you were walking a lot of it. And I'm since learned in the, and by the way, this is the ultra community. Like even Courtney DeWalter, when she did her thing, she was walking. Like fast hiking and strategic hiking and running is part of it. And it all of a sudden gave me permission to not have that coach from 100 years ago in my head saying, well, if you're running, it doesn't count. It all of a sudden gave me permission seeing you do these successful events and getting out there in a way that was in your version of success, allowed me to reframe. And then I put it into action with this last year's 29-29. I actually sent it to you as soon as we signed up, decided to sign up for it. And we're doing 3 marathons a day, but we have 12 hours to finish them. And so it's a strategic, like, do we run as fast as we can so we have more time to recovery? Do we go long so we use less energy, like that mental game? And then if it's a really shitty day, you end up on a trail. It's pretty awesome.
Right, right.
So I have you to thank for some of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's been my philosophy in so many of these long, you know, these 100 milers that I've run and things, is I've generally picked gorgeous places to be so that if I'm having, you know, abject misery, I can always stop for a minute and look around and just appreciate how damn lucky I am to be there. And that's, you know, that's that whole, like, whatever, finding awesome thing that I always sort of developed, is that you literally can find that in the middle of, you know, a huge pity party with lots and lots of physical pain. there still is this great, you know, this idea that you're doing something amazing and that you get to do this thing. And even if you fail at it, you still are getting to fail at it. You know, yeah. That, you know, you may have not even imagined getting to toe the line of something like the Tahoe Rim 100.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And that's, I mean, I think the three things I think about is I chose this, right? If you hate it, you can stop. Well, of course, I didn't sign up to stop. So, you know, now I'm having an internal battle with myself and it's like, I'm not freaking stopping. But yeah, there were a couple times I was having some asthma issues and you just stand in the woods at Whistler and it was snowing and foggy and just turn around and like breathe the air. That was amazing. And then the third one, and I know this is important to you, is the people. Holy crap. Yeah. Like if you open yourself up and say hi to people and thank the volunteers and engage, and I think that is kind of the core of who you are, knowing you, like that buoys you in a way that nothing else can. You just get over yourself real quick when you appreciate the people who are standing there in the cold all night to make sure you have a potato chip. Yeah. That's something else.
Yeah. And especially the ultra community, this whole concept of a sport where the elites, you know, the world elites of the sport, for the most part in US races, they toe the line right there with you. And if you're on a course that happens to be looped or has out and backs or something like that, you end up seeing these people. And for the most part, you know, 98% of them, they're going to say to you as you go by, good job.
Yeah.
You know, way to go, man. Something like that. Or I'll holler out to them because I'll know them and I'll be like, oh, you know, I haven't seen Courtney on the trail, but I would say something like, you know, crush it, Courtney. And I guarantee you, she's going to throw back something positive to me.
Yeah.
It's just such a trip. It's like no other sport can you do that.
No, and it aligns with me. I mean, I'm short. I'm not a gazelle body. And so many times I'd show up at events and just feel shame, right? Do I have the right clothes? I don't look like them. I have too much body fat, all the things that we're taught. Whereas in the trail running community, it's you do you, boo. And that's, again, I love Courtney in her big baggy shorts and t-shirt. Like, I think she knows this, but if, you know, if she doesn't, and God, would that be amazing to get her on this podcast? Cause she's someone I think lives stoked in the sense of like, I'm not wearing the cute little singlets and stuff. I am wearing what I want to wear. And I remember it was a Salomon Instagram ad and they were talking about food and two of her fellow racers were like, I try to get 3.4 ounces every 15 minutes and do this and that. And they go to Courtney, what do you eat? Jujubes? I don't know. Yeah. And it's just like, it's another way to be high performance without being high performance. So I think you tend towards that side too. You do you, you do it, have a great time and not get too caught up in the noise.
Yep. I borrow a phrase from a great individual out here in North Carolina named Hunt Brumby, who called himself the back of the pack ambassador. And I like to think of myself as that kind of thing too. Like I like being in the, I would say the middle to the back of the pack, but very often I've been in the back of the pack all the way, but I'm having as much fun as possible back there and appreciating, you know, everything back there. And yeah, I want to make it to the finish line under the cutoffs, but I'm trying to have a lot as much fun as possible in these things, you know, even my training runs.
Yeah. I mean, you need to come back another day. Even when I was training for 29:29, there were days where like my heart, like, I don't want to do this. And I'm like, that's what burned me out before. Like, I'm going to take a rest day. And it was as much my head as it was my body. My heart wasn't into doing the workout today. And I can tell the nuance versus just letting it go versus, no, my heart and mental needs to not be on today. And that 80% of doing the training was hard for me, but it was everything. And I think what made me successful. And as I build my business or I do other things, you know, us caregivers don't necessarily take care of ourselves so well.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to tell you the thing. I'm dying to see your accent. I'm a little nervous because if you don't even remember it, I'm going to be sad. Because this is live stoked, lead stoked, right? And it is my belief that if you live your life despite roles and identities put upon you or that we put upon ourselves, you know, once you're grounded in yourself, then you can be better leader, whether it's in your community, as a member of board of a race team, or in your business, because you're no longer trying to compare yourself to others and you're helping them to live stoked, which then creates stoked environments. That's the line that makes sense to me. So many years ago, we went on a call for backup with a local fire department for one of the stinkiest calls ever. Are you tracking with me? Do you know where I'm going?
Yeah, I'm tracking with you. I have an idea.
And this stinky call is infamous in the medical field as being one of the stinkiest calls. So you walk in the house and you can almost smell it the driveway. And the firefighters were putting Vicks vapor rub on and masks. And I had learned the Jedi mind trick breathing, which is breathing over the back of your tongue where you don't have taste buds and all this stuff. And you sit there and you just take a deep nose breath and inhale. And you said, ah, sometimes you just have to revel in the stench and revel how bad it can be. Do you remember this?
Revel in it. Yes. I have to give some credit to that, to the originator of Revel in It.
Yes.
Do you remember Dirk Steensma?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yes. Our great Australian friend, who I always told every patient who was riding in the back with him that he was from New Zealand, just to really piss him off. But he was the one who originally coined, he told me once that when I was trying to deal with a smell, and he said, revel in it, Goldie. And ever since then, I realized that, yeah, like when it's really bad, sometimes the best thing to do is just to really just dig into it. Just because a bad smell like that, you can try all you want to avoid it, but it just smells like GI bleed with Vicks.
Yes.
You know, it smells like the back of your tongue has GI bleed on it. Like you can't get rid of it and you can't get it out of your clothes afterwards. And at night you will roll over and you'll smell it on your pillow. So sometimes the best thing to do is just go, yeah, that's it right there. That's what I'm here for.
And that has been a leadership lesson, because I think leaders sometimes want to skip over how hard it is. And yeah. I tell your story, and think of it, a room of executives, and I tell your story. And I said, but that's the thing we have to do going through COVID. Sometimes you just have to revel, like, hey, everyone, this really sucks. It is hard. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I think you've got it. I think we've got it. Or we're going to learn from it, or we're going to be better on the other end. And it's such a way, and I think it aligns with your awesome, right? It's even when it sucks, and this is not toxic positivity at all for anyone who's thinking that that's where we're going. We're not at all. It's a honest transparency and willingness to just, yeah, it sucks. It's cool. Like, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of runners who throw the phrase around, embrace the suck.
Yeah.
And that's essentially the same thing. You know, in a hard race or maybe climbing, like in Tahoe Rim Trail, there was a section that it was a 1.8 mile, something like, I don't know, an 1800 foot elevation gain. It was a ski, it was a black diamond ski run that they made us hike up twice. And it was awful. But the second time up, what I did was I realized that I had made it once before and it was hard, and I knew where the end was now, and I recognized where I was going to be, and I knew what was in front of me, and I knew I just had to suck it up and get through it, and I had to just throw myself into it. It was going to be slow, it was going to eventually be over, and I knew I would survive it, so I just had to revel in it. You know, I just had to do it.
Well, just for reference, our 29029 event was...
Yeah.
One lap was 4 miles and 4,000 feet of climbing. So the same ratio.
Nice.
And we did it 8 times.
Sweet. That's some good vert.
That's some good vert. There were some definite revel in the stench moments. Well, I'm so glad you remember. Yeah. And I love that there's a call out to Dirk on that one.
Yeah, I got to get him to listen to the podcast
next. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it is a key life and leadership lesson.
Yep.
Well, I suppose the question I have for you is, okay, you've done 600 milers.
Yeah.
And like, is there a point that there's a next thing? Where do you go from there? Because it's like 100 miles is significant, and that's something in itself. But where do you go from there? Like from our 29029, it was like, well, what do? Well, we want to go faster. So this trail event came up. It was like, oh, cool. That's the next thing.
Yeah.
Where do you go from here? How do you choose your things?
Well, part of it is, are you familiar with the Western States 100?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the Western States 100 requires that you run a qualifying race each year, which allows you to earn a certain number of tickets that increase over time. So the first year you do it, you get one ticket in the lottery. The next year you do it, you get two, then four, then eight, then 16. So each year since I started running hundreds, so 2019 was when I ran the Umsted 100, I've been picking 100-mile races, or in the case of the race in Portugal, is 115K. That were qualifiers for the Western States lottery. The odds to get into the Western States based on the lottery are horrifically bad, because there's something like, I don't know, 80,000 tickets or something crazy. It's some insane number. I can't remember what it was last year, but it was bigger than ever. So my odds this last year, I had 8 tickets in, and my odds were something like 4% chance to get in. And so, of course, I didn't get picked. But this, by that same token, every year, some people get picked that have 1 ticket or 2 tickets, you know, because it's a lottery. So what I've been doing is I've been picking races that are on this list, but I've been trying to pick different races every year to not repeat things. And I've been trying to pick races that are an adventure of some kind in their own right. Like they'd stand by themselves for like the best thing I do all year, despite the fact that I'm picking it because they're part of this lottery qualification. So that's how I ended up in Portugal at the Madeira 115K. I had a friend from Norway that had run it a bunch of times and sent me pictures. And it's just staggeringly beautiful course, right? I've done Tahoe Rim Trail was the same thing, you know, beautiful course, heard a lot of great things about it. Zion was the same thing. And then this year I signed up for the Crazy Mountain 100 in Montana, which is only, it's only third year running, and it's the first year it's a qualifying race for Western States. And it scares the hell out of me. It's 100 miles and something like 25,000 feet of gain with extremely technical terrain. But really, really gorgeous. Like a place in Montana that you can't get to easily without being part of this race, because it's on a combination of protected Crow Indian land and ranches and private land and all this stuff. And so there's this beautiful point to point through these amazing mountains that, you know, God willing, I can actually make it. So that's kind of how my plan has been. And so there's this goal of running Western States. And ironically, Western States, it's a pretty course. But really, it's more about the icon that is Western States and the hype around it and the legacy and lore around it that would be so enjoyable to do. That being said, I never say never to the crazy other like ideas moving forward. And I'm toying with the idea of a 200 or 200 plus mile race or a last person standing race.
Holy crap.
Both of which are completely different animals, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the 200 milers are, there's so much strategy involved with sleeping and eating and controlling your pace and, you know, sleep deprivation and all that stuff. You know, they take closer to, you know, 4 to 5 days as opposed to, you know, the longest 100 miler I ever did. I think I finished just under 35 hours or something, or right at 35 hours. And then a last person standing race is nobody knows how long it'll go. And you're just running 4.67 miles every top of every hour. And that's all about personal management of yourself, because you're running the same little loop. It's not interesting. It's not beautiful. But you have this amazing community that happens around these things. And you, when you do run with elites, you are literally running with elites at the top of every hour. And if you hang long enough, then it's just like you and a few elites, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't know. I've thought about that just because it may be in my wheelhouse. I'm getting a little bit slower. It seems like every race I run, I'm getting closer to the cutoffs. And some of that's because I'm picking hard races, but I am getting a little bit slower, but I feel like I may have the endurance still and can work on that. So that may be the next things I do.
I'm going to say this very carefully, because you're older than me.
Not by much.
I don't even remember, but you seem so much wiser back then. So I just assume decades. But I mean, they say as we age, we are better wired for endurance, and that you're actually coming into your prime.
Right. Yeah. My mental game has gotten better and better.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I have been, you know, knock on wood, I've been injury free this year. And for the most part, you know, I haven't had any bad stuff. But yeah, the mental game has gotten better and better for me. And I still have a pity party at about mile 20 to 30, pretty much every race. But because it's just like, there's so much more to go, and you have that little realization, and you have to pull yourself back and say, just run this mile, just run to the next aid station. Don't forget, doesn't always get worse. That's David Horton's famous phrase. Yep. It doesn't always get worse. And it generally gets better at some point, or at least different.
Yeah.
You know, at least it changes. You know, your feet hurt right now, but don't worry. Later, your hips will hurt and your feet, you won't.
That's the thing I marveled at, because I have issues with my back from sitting in the front seat of a car for 12 hours a day. And you know, the right side would hurt. And then after a while, the left side would hurt. And it's like, oh, yeah, just keep going. Like, I can differentiate by this is debilitate, but it's like, oh, just stop it. You're going to go away in a little bit. Just keep going. But on that race, I remember my husband and I took a sign of the 500 feet sign. It was like, we were parting. It was so awesome. And by the end, it was like, fuck that sign. Oh my God. I do not want to, because that meant we had, 4,000 more feet to go. And it just, oh gosh, why did we get all hyped about that damn sign? But my mantra on the way, the last lap was just every step forward is one step closer to your goal. And literally I probably said that no less than 42,000 times to get me up that hill.
Yep. That's good.
Another huge part of something that's important to you is music.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your music, and then I got a big question for you.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Well, let's see. I play harmonica and sing in a band. I've been playing music for, 20-something years. Basically, kind of when I got out of college, I started messing around and got into a band that was through connections with my sister, and did some music out in California for a while, and was playing in a band, when I knew you and a bunch of, other EMS folks would come out. And then I moved out to North Carolina and kind of didn't do anything for a long time, and then played in an acoustic duo for about 10 years or so, until we sort of started to peter out a little bit before COVID. And then COVID just put the kibosh on it completely. Like, that was it. We weren't interested enough to try to keep it going even between us. And so it just kind of died out, and that was okay. It was, we had kind of played it out. And then towards, well, I guess it was the second year of COVID, I got an email from a guy that responded to my band mix profile, which is basically like Tinder for musicians, right? And I had put this profile up maybe, 10 years prior or something. And he said, are you still interested in playing? And he had a couple of guys that had a singer that they lost, before COVID, because she moved and they hadn't done anything in a while, and they were all vaccinated and wanted to start, jamming again. So they were looking for people that would be willing to get together and jam. And so we ended up forming this band, the Motel Keys. And we've been playing a bunch now, which is great. And it's super fun. It's a great feeling to be back out there making music and having fun with it. And we just play covers of blues and classic rock stuff, some more obscure things when we can, and just have a blast doing it. So that's a fun thing. Definitely.
Yeah. And certainly I had been out there in Point Reyes a few times for seeing the band out there with the crew.
Right. At the old Western
Saloon. Old Western Saloon. It was awesome. I think there's an old picture we have of one of the times that just every once in a while shows itself on Facebook or somewhere. I'm like, oh my God, that was so fun. So my question for you is, and we haven't talked about your two daughters. You mentioned you have a dog. Yeah. You said you're semi-retiring in this job, but knowing you're still working hard. So you're an ERPA, you're an ultra runner, and you're a musician. How in AT-double toothpicks do you do it all?
Well, it's really funny. Like, I was really busy for a while, though. When I was working in the emergency department, it was definitely harder to juggle everything. And it essentially eliminated any kind of personal life.
Yeah.
Which I was okay with, because, really my favorite people on earth were my two kids. And that's the only people I wanted to spend time with. And thankfully, my dog's pretty chill. So if I was neglecting him a little bit, he still has a dog door and can get to the yard and run around himself. So that's good. And at the time, I wasn't really doing all that much with music. So it was just finding the time to run was the only thing. Audrey, my oldest, went to college. She's in her third year now at University of St. Andrews in Scotland. So, she left then, and then Coralie just started this year at Drexel. So I became an empty nester all of a sudden this year. And this was, very shortly after I had switched out of the emergency room to a, basically a 9-to-5. It's not even 9-to-5. It's more like, 8-ish to 4-ish. And I'm working from home 3 days a week job. That's why I kind of joke and say that I feel like I'm semi-retired, because it's so much more amenable to everything else in my life, because I'm not working nights and I'm not working weekends and holidays like I was before. So I like to be, to be busy, but I find a way to juggle all of that. You end up with your friends being your running friends. I'm in a relationship with someone who's a runner, so that helps, that we get to do things together. And we both understand if each other has to go off and do their run differently, and it's not a big deal. And yeah. I don't know. I like to be busy.
Well, and it's something that, I think
one of the reasons why, we've connected, this is not our first time connecting in 30 years, and thankful for social media, but you had a different approach to even being in the field when we were EMTs, right? And before paramedic. And I'm going to ask you a question that I probably should have teed up beforehand, because it is a thoughtful question. There's a lot of talk now in rescue around post-traumatic stress, around well-being. I think, now recognizing the impact of being a paramedic for you many years longer than me being in the ER. And I would have assumed your way of being just keeps you immune to some of that. But at the same time, I'm sure you have thoughts, because you're a thoughtful person, is thoughts on, like, we know the stress of being a paramedic EMT, the physiological stress isn't different necessarily if you missed your numbers in corporate America, or, you're ending, you get laid off or whatever. Physiologically, in some ways, the stress is stress is stress. I would love to get your thoughts on that topic, because I actually was talking to someone who was retiring out from being a firefighter, and he had a heart condition and he wasn't ready. He's retiring out because of it. And his talk about his mental emotional state, it was heartbreaking, right? Because you could sense he was lost. You could sense he had that. That's one side of it. But even then, just carrying the baggage, I would even say I have some post-traumatic stress. I would say I had a benign career, but I still go to places and I remember where that house was with the GI bleed. I remember where that call went. And it just is with you. So I'd love your thoughts on that and keep it wide open and see where you go with it. Because yeah. I think there is a way you have navigated this world that allows you to do all this stuff. Whether it's a chicken and egg, the stuff allows you to do the work, or your approach in life too allows you to do all the extra stuff. I'll shush and I'll let you answer now.
It is a lot of chicken and egg, I think. Yeah. This whole idea of, medical provider burnout, it's a hot topic now, but it's not that it didn't exist before. And it certainly existed before COVID, but I definitely was part of that population of medical providers, in emergency department especially, who just put their head down and keep plowing forward and trying and trying and trying to push that square peg into the round hole every single shift. And I tell this story to my colleagues at the board and when we're hiring somebody for the board and things like that, that I didn't really realize, I had an inkling that I wouldn't be able to continue doing it, but I didn't realize how close I was to burnout. Until I had a carrot dangled in front of me of this other lifestyle, of a more relaxed and a more controlled lifestyle, to say, wow, you could actually have that. You don't have to get up every day and fight the good fight. Like I'm proud. I'm super proud of what I was able to accomplish with my team in the beginning of COVID in the emergency room. Like it was a war. I was involved in a war with my fellow soldiers against a virus and against an epidemic on so many different levels. And we all just rallied, and it was great. It was a great feeling. But the following year, when that was still there and we were still fighting, it's a lot like a war when you start to wonder, what am I doing here? Why am I continuing to put my head up above the trench to get shot at over and over and over and over again? And I think that's one of the reasons there's been such terrible turnover in the medical field, especially with nursing and ancillary staff and things like that. I mean, I think a lot of doctors get stuck because they can't really jump to anything else very easily. If you're an emergency medicine certified physician, you kind of have to finish your career as an emergency certified physician, unless you're willing to take a huge pay cut and go into education or administration or something like that. So I count myself very lucky that I was offered an opportunity that just sort of literally fell in my lap. And I didn't realize until I stepped away from emergency medicine that I had done it just in time, really.
Yeah.
And in terms of like how I kept myself sane during all that, like all that buildup, those years of working, I was very busy in orthopedics, and that had its own stress, the number of patients you were supposed to have on your docket every day in clinic and all this stuff, is I wasn't managing well for a while. I didn't get the diagnosis of depression, but I got, we sort of came up with anhedonia is what my therapist called it, just said that inability to feel happiness. you know, of all people, me who like finds something to be happy about every day, I was at a point where literally I couldn't find anything to be happy about. Or if I identified something that should be making me happy, it still didn't work. And I was still going through life. I was doing my job well. I was being the best dad I could, all that stuff. But I wasn't doing anything for myself, really, is what it came down to really take care of myself. And it sounds cliche, but I feel like running saved my life. You know, I was going into a bad place. I was headed into, you know, darker depression state for sure. And running at first was not, it didn't seem good. It seemed awkward and painful. And I kept telling myself it was not for me. But somehow, for some reason, and I can't even put my finger on the why that I did it, I was able to keep doing it long enough to get to that point where I ended up finding my happy spot. And that was, you know, after those two marathons where, you know, I did those marathons based on expectations of others, yep, really, of like what people are supposed to do. And when you have a marathon where you hit the wall the first time, then you're supposed to retrain so you can be better the second time. And it didn't work. Yeah. And what I found was that doing it for myself, which meant, you know, running around in the woods and walking the uphills if I felt like it, or sitting in a stream if I felt like it, that was going to bring me joy. And it actually brought me fitness and health, you know, mental and physical.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't love that you went through all that. I think a lot of people went through different versions of that. But the solution I have found over the years, and this was, you know, me growing up from my burnout, was it's the little things, right? For me, it started with a walk and being able to walk from the suburb I was in and just being in farmland and seeing the fog sitting in that farmland, that fresh air. I mean, you're not in California now, but I bet, you know, having grown up where you did, you can feel that moistness on your face and feel that fresh air and that deep breath. And the power of connecting to that and letting it influence you, I think, is something that I kept talking about, is like sitting in that stream and realizing you're using it to fill your tank and such. And I think one of the things that's important as I do this work and the Live Stoked is that role that's put upon you, right? As savior, rescuer. And COVID was extreme, but at the same time, you know, when we are filling our tank in the industries in these worlds, being a physician, there's not a lot of room to take care of yourself and do what you need to do to take care of yourself. And I suppose it was a gift for me. I actually kept my paramedic license 6 years after I left the ambulance because I couldn't let it go. And I got a pay. Yeah. I rejoined Rocky Mountain Rescue and I was like, oh, I get to do this in my way and I won't burn myself out again. And I'll never forget, I got a page and it was a body recovery and my heart just said, no more, I'm done. There was some psychological research saying that rescuers have a certain amount of hours to give. And some it might be a year and some it might be a career, but there's a point where they hit and they're done, right? And unfortunately, for those who choose a long career, that hour may come and we've known people like that and they keep going, right? And the impact on them is quite significant. And I wouldn't be dramatic. I can be dramatic with you up to and including death, because they crossed over that either that line or went to a different direction. And I'll never forget when I was retiring out of being a paramedic, it was like, what kind of asshole are you? You save lives for a living. You know, what kind of, you know, that's not enough for you, but that needs to be okay. And I don't think there's space in healthcare and especially frontline healthcare to put yourself and have that be enough. So as you made that decision in that space, did you have any of that kind of that, I don't even know how to describe it, because that is a compelling identity. And we talk about working on identities of roles we may have put upon us. But for me, the identity of paramedic and being in EMS superseded anything I had for myself.
Yeah, definitely. The big struggle I had was more recently when I switched from the ER doing clinical medicine and going into the work for the board, which is regulatory, which means that I legally cannot work anywhere because it would be a conflict of interest. I can technically volunteer, but I'm done with clinical medicine, essentially. From walked out one day, my shift went till 8 o'clock at night. And the next morning at 8 a.m., I was starting at the board. It was just like a light switch. And I worried because everybody always gave me lots of great feedback on my bedside manner, and I'm doing such a good job for people. It's such a great thing I do. I give and give, and you know how much I can really contribute to society being an emergency medicine PA, like all the good that comes with that. And I thought, you know, wow, it seems sort of selfish to just take that away. you know, I was also lead PA at my practice. So I was a mentor to people. People looked up to me. People relied on me. And here I was just going to step away for a completely selfish reason. But it's the best thing I could have done. Yeah. Because, you know, I sort of walked away. I don't know if I was at the top of my game. I think I was on the just past the apex of the top of the game, because I was starting to head into this realm of feeling like I just didn't really love being there anymore. Wasn't as excited to go to work. But I was at a point where I still, you know, was doing a good job and was respected and could leave with that, and not as a curmudgeonly old guy who should have left 5 years prior.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was definitely a leap of faith for sure to make a huge change like that. But it was important to realize that that didn't dictate my identity. And really, if anything, that's still my identity. Like, I'm still a prior emergency medicine PA. That doesn't change. I'm also a prior paramedic. You know, I'm proud of the years I was a paramedic. I'm proud of the years that before all of that, when I was selling rap music out of, you know, Master P's trunk of his car.
I forgot about that.
But yeah, that's my true claim.
Yes.
Is that I sold Master P's first album.
Oh my God. That.
Distributed it, I should say. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that it doesn't eliminate your identity. You know, you're all those things. You're everything you were all the way along the line. It's just that we do, you know, traditionally we say, what are you now? Yeah. But, and I've had to think about that in terms of running too. I mean, there's the runners talk about it all the time. Like, what happens when you one day can't run anymore, you know, or that day comes where there's no point in trying to be in the Western States lottery because you're not going to be able to finish 100-miler anymore.
Yeah.
And does that ruin it for you? And I firmly believe that I will be able to make that transition, because I will have diversified my, you know, my love for that community into all these other, you know, outlets.
And I think that's the key, because I think a lot of us don't think about what's on the other side. I got swept up into career, married my firefighter sweetheart, and, you know, I tell this story in episode one, and this all happened after we worked together, but really let the whole career take me, and I had no other backup plan. I had no sense of self. I let the fancy uniform. I mean, I was told what to wear. I was told what to think. I was told what to drive. It was pretty easy for me to just give up my own identity to that whole thing. And, you know, translating that into, I can see the parallels now, but I remember when I quit was on disability and starting to retrain and find other jobs. I went into a temp agency and like, I had nothing to give. No one cared about my innovation rates or how fast I drove or how nice my square handwriting, because that was back in the day when we still wrote our PCRs. And right. And having to learn to translate, and that was the biggest gift, how to translate your bedside manner to now being on a board to influence policy and things that are important, how to translate getting through the night and getting through the suck, reveling in the stench in order to navigate this period of life. Like, you know, it's, I think why I started this podcast and who I want to speak to is us when we were at those precipices and maybe not even seeing ourselves, and whether it's the role, what we told ourselves, or just not giving us a chance to think about what's next and that I could have something different, is the thing that gets in our way. And living stoked is not always easy, because I bet you're going through all sorts of growing pains, just even learning how to contribute well in a world that probably was pretty automatic. That's part of the journey. And living stoked isn't always easy, but you choose it and it helps you to grow, whether it's a 200 miler, which I could barely even say it. I could barely do that on a bike, let alone on a trail, but, you know, or a new career change, or even navigating being an empty nester, right? And watching your girls live a life on their choice. Yes, you want it, but it doesn't mean it's easy.
Right. Yeah. That's the problem with kids raising kids like this and raising them to be independent and good at what they do and intelligent and fearless, is that they become independent and intelligent and fearless and actually go and do all that. And then you're left behind going, yeah, why?
Wait a minute.
Can I help?
Come on. Can I help you with something?
There's always something I can help them with. It's just that it's green.
It's green. What does that mean?
Money.
Oh, yes.
They always give money still. So I still have a need. I still have a place. No, they're great. They do reach out. And part of what I do, I mean, they always talk about, you know, that you have to have a why, right? For all these big efforts that you do. And it's for whatever, like, you know, why am I picking a job that's good for me as well, and a career that means something? Part of that is always, you know, that I'm doing it to lead by example for my yeah. children. You know, if they can see me doing these hard things and they can see me deal with the struggle and the doubt and succeed, then they're going to know they can actually do anything they want. They really actually yeah. can.
And it's such a gift. I don't think us as Gen Xers got that lesson. You know, we yeah. didn't get that. It didn't feel as much like a choice because we were, you know, raised by the next generation. Put your head down, work hard. You get the watch after yeah. 30 years. You get to vacation later. And I don't know about you, but I feel tweener kind of between the millennials of, I want to live for today. I'm not waiting for the damn watch at 50 when I can't. Well, oh, see, I am 50. God, I don't even know how old I am anymore. Jesus. But, you know, like doing the things today, which actually as a 50-year-old, I could argue I can't do. I'm too old. It's that train has left the station and Matt and I are like, oh, hell no. We get to choose when it's going to go out the station. But right. Anyway, well, being mindful, I appreciate you kind of going to that deeper place because I think, you know, whether yours is a medical emergency services career, but whether you're in finance or something that is compelling in your life and that changes, it has impacts. And, you know, whether it's COVID, whether it's a depression, whatever the thing is, being able to maintain our ability to choose and have therapists and providers that can help us see what we can't necessarily see. I couldn't see it for myself. So it literally took an injury to slow me down enough. We don't need to do that to ourselves.
Right.
So as we close this out, I would like to know, what are you reading, listening to, watching? It doesn't have to be serious, deep thoughts or anything. Just kind of what's on your mind? What are you enjoying?
Let's see. My sister and I watched NIAID last night. That was good. That was another good story of, you know, overcoming struggle and all that. Although very interesting movie because she's kind of a jerk. You know, she's very self-centered and kind of, you know, just demands a lot of others around her. But there's a lot of lessons from that. And it's actually the peripheral characters in that movie that I think were the most entertaining and inspirational, mm-hmm. honestly. Mm-hmm. Let's see. What else am I reading? I read my Ultra Running magazine a lot. That's fun. The book I'm reading, I can't remember the guy's name now suddenly. It's a Japanese author called What I Think About When I'm Running. I actually did read a really good book. It's behind me here. Let's see. There's a couple of them. The Mental Training for Ultra okay. Running by Addie Bracey. That's a great book for anybody who's thinking about doing ultra running. And then you would probably dig this book, When Good Trails Go Bad. This is written by a guy, Stephen Littlewood, who's a search and rescue guy. And he basically, it's his, he used to do search and rescue training for search and rescue people. And then he realized that was great, except that really, if you could train the public to not need search and rescue to begin with, that might be even better. So he does kind of the layperson search and rescue, like how you can avoid, you know, bad things happening to you, or when the bad things do happen, that you've at least been prepped enough for it and all those kinds of things. And he jokes about sort of like adult merit badges, things you should learn how to do.
Oh, I love it.
Kind of thing. That's a good one too. So yeah, those were a couple of good books recently. I'm coached by a guy that's called Running Is Life Coaching. And he does a book review every so often, like every other month or something. We review a book and we have meetings and talk about it and stuff like that. And those were a couple that we reviewed.
Nice. And well, and even that mental training for ultras, your first 5K can feel like an ultra. I mean, you know, yeah. The never say never, I thought I'd never do a marathon. Well, we finished our event. I did 30 miles hiking uphill, you know, the same degree of that 1.6 or 1.8 mile hill that you went up. And I did 30 miles of that, right? And it's like, yeah. Oh, I'm an ultra endurance athlete, you know? And right. So I definitely check that one out because you don't have to be running ultras to do that mental training. So thank you. We're going to put them all in the show notes and we will figure out that author's name. So any last thoughts before we log off?
No, I think I'm really stoked that you're doing this. You know, not even throwing stoked out there as a catchphrase, but truly happy to have seen you doing more things and diversifying yourself even further and getting yourself out there. I think it's incredible.
Thank you. And thank you for saying yes and trusting me implicitly because you had no clue what story I was going to tell. And to our listeners, yep. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this. Ratings are important. So stars, likes, reviews, whatever the hell you're supposed to do, just do it. That would be great. Share this. And we'll see you next time. Thanks so much for joining us for Live Stoked, Lead Stoked. We know you're busy, so it means the world to me that you'd spend this time with us. If you're interested in digging deeper on the topics discussed today, be sure to check out the show notes for resources and links related to this episode. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button if you found this to be time well spent. Your support helps us immensely. Plus, consider leaving a review. They're like virtual high fives, and I appreciate every one of them. Finally, stay connected with us on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Feel free to shoot us a message or a question. Your stories and experiences enrich the community we're building here, and you never know, your question may end up on a monthly Ask Me Anything. So until next time, keep subscribing, keep reviewing, and keep living your most stoked life. We'll be back with more inspiration, stories, and insights. See you then.